we are as body, soul creatures, that we can't pull this apart and think either about ourselves as purely spiritual beings or as purely material beings. And this is significant. And so, you know, as I was thinking through, I talked through a few of those implications, and then I was reminded of maybe one that I should have had on there, but probably didn't, because I was talking about this with my wife, who I should probably have listed her as like a co-teacher of this course, because even though she's not up here, I'm like running these ideas by, like, here, and then she's always like, what happened in class? What are you guys talking about? So we're kind of going through this process, and I'm like, and obviously I teach this class as a man. It's not surprising anybody. I hope. But you know, it's helpful for me to say, you know, here's something that this male theologian said. What do you think about this? And so it's interesting then to hear kind of her feedback, because I recognize the perspective from which I teach this course. And so one of the things that she reminded me of, you know, we talk about the fact that we are these body-soul creatures, and that we can't pull this apart. And one of the things I think then that is significant about that is that when you do get, yes, you guys need handouts?
Yeah.
All right, a couple lectures. That when we think about who we are as body-soul creatures, this means that the closer you get to a person, especially to a person that there is a potential attraction for, the closer you get to a person, the more natural it is to want to be close to them bodily or physically. Right? If there's that potential there. At least I think that is often the case. And so that's why, I mean, we can have an argument about exactly how long engagements or dating should be or that kind of thing. But I think there's a good reason why, if you are getting closer to a person, that it is a natural progression to want to be close to them physically as well. Right? Does that make sense? That's why I coined, you know, to explain this to dating couples, I've coined the phrase, the couple that prays together, lays together. Right? Yeah. Clever, rhyming. And I think in part we yeah, there can be the tendency to say, well, this is this is a bad thing, that I'm feeling more and more attracted to this person, and it's becoming harder to resist temptation here. But I think we also have to say there's something natural to that, right? That's actually the way that it is supposed to be, that there's this body soul connection. So as we think about today, and as we launch into our discussion of thinking about how the fall has affected us, I would say there are a couple of key questions. The first is, how do we sort out proper sexual desire from inordinate or disordered sexual desire? Yeah, this is a really key question in terms of trying to articulate and trying to define this distinction. But I think we do want to affirm that there is a distinction, that we don't want to say sexual desire in and of itself is bad. There have been some, a few people throughout Christian history have said something kind of like that, but I want to resist that a little bit. And I think another key question is, in our present state, how can we hold creation, fall, and redemption together as we await the final consummation? And here's what I mean by that. You know, it can be very easy, Wes talks about today, that we overemphasize the fall. So this is where he talks about this kind of interpretation of suspicion, that you can't look at another human being without lust, right? Or a human being, right? And he says, that's a problem, because we want to say there's something good about attraction and desire there. So some Christians might fall off, you know, this side and overemphasize the fall. On the other hand, it can be a problem to overemphasize perhaps creation or redemption, to where we almost become oblivious to the reality of sin's effects. So we don't want to just act like, well, usually when somebody's like, well, I'm immune to sexual temptation, that's when you got to keep a close eye on that person. All right? As though they're just completely above that or without that. And so we want to try to hold these together, and it's not easy. Now, here are just a few questions that I think in different ways and from different angles try to get at some of these things. Should a male pastor call his wife smoking hot?
Yes.
Yes? No? Maybe so? as inspired by, I don't know, Ricky Bobby. And then the actual pastor who copied Ricky Bobby praying for the NASCAR. I don't know if anyone has actually seen that YouTube, but it's out there.
A couple of years ago, my friend who is a graduate from here referred to his wife as smoking hot in front of a bunch of students, and it was pretty interesting.
Okay.
Like 60 students.
Yeah. So, again, when you think about this, I think a lot of these questions, you can take them from different angles. You know, somebody might say, well, you know, this is okay. This is just a way for somebody to express the fact, yes, I'm physically attracted to my spouse. I think they're attractive. I think they're beautiful. Yet others, I think, would say that the way that this terminology is used really risks objectifying a person. Or it can play into how the broader culture, that person might mean that in a perfectly fine way, but in some ways it's reductionistic. It reduces them to something to be looked at. Yeah.
I think it's a good thing to say. It's not good if it's the only thing that's said.
Okay.
And that's like the only term of, like, this is who my wife is.
Yeah.
Is like the fact that she's really attractive. Then there's a problem.
Yeah.
But if it's, she's an awesome person and she's also really attractive, then.
Yeah. It could go either way. All right, so we're going to break up in just a minute. I'm going to give you the chance to talk about, pick whatever question you want and argue about it with your neighbor in a second. But I just want to run through these questions briefly. Do calls for modesty unfairly make women responsible for men's sin? Or vice versa? Right? And so, you can understand both angles. You would want to say, whether you're male or female, you don't want to be a stumbling block for somebody else. At the same time, right, unless we're all going to wear like full body coverings, male and female, you have to say, you know, the problem, I think the root problem, is with the gaze, not with a person's body. Although, of course, people can dress specifically to get attention. So you guys can debate about this more in a minute. Is sexual pleasure the result of the fall? You find this actually in some early church fathers who would say that sex is so pleasurable and that's because of God's judgment. Because we rebel against God, there's this kind of disorder in the world. We reject God, and so God gives us this kind of disorder to make us in some sense aware of the disorder that's out there. And so, again, there's probably a spectrum here of where different people might fall on this, but it's interesting. In a world without sin, would we have complete control over physical sexual arousal? This is something that Augustine talks about in his book City of God. You know, he asked the question, you know, maybe you've never thought about this, you know, what exactly would sex have been like before the fall? And now I think Augustine's own experience factors into this. If you know his story, he struggled with sexual sin for well over a decade of his life. But he thought, and again, this is where I had this conversation with my wife to say, what do you think about this coming from a male theologian? He thought, you know, we have control over many of the members of our body. But as a man, he experienced sexual desire as something that in many cases just overwhelmed him from outside. Sometimes he felt like he was doing things or wanted things that he didn't want. And so he thought, you know, this would be much more mental than it currently is. It would be much more rational that you would, you know, I don't know. Yeah, anyway, in the particulars of what this would look like in Augustine's mind. But he goes through and gives examples of how, you know, you have human beings have control over their bodies in some very interesting ways. You know, he mentions sword swallowers. This is one of the most interesting passages in City of God. Because he mentions sword swallowers. He mentions people who can... how does he phrase it? It's like, I know there's a man who can make all kinds of sounds from his anus, right? It's like, I kid you not. It's like some dude's farting ability somehow factors into his theological discussion. And so he thinks about this. And this is why it was interesting to have this conversation with my wife, because she said, you know, maybe men are more fallen than women are. Because she said, in her experience... as a woman, she said, I feel like it is more mental than you're telling me it is in your experience. And so that was interesting.
does attraction or falling in love imply a loss of control that's the result of the fall? Right? So when you talk about attraction, or I think there's a reason we use a term like falling in love, because there's a sense in which you're overwhelmed by something outside of you. That you are, you know, if you're, maybe some of you who are working, you know, especially with youth, you know, if there's this feeling of, I'm infatuated with this person, not because I woke up one day and decided to be, but there's this sense of, I'm attracted to this person. So how does that factor into this discussion? Is labeling someone attractive or beautiful in and of itself wrong or right? How do we think about this? To say, this is a beautiful, and think about this as well. When we say someone's attractive or beautiful, I think most of the time, sometimes we might mean purely physically, but usually if we say something like, I'm attracted to someone, you say, I'm attracted to some person, not just I'm attracted to some body. Right? And so it can, right? Those lines can be blurred. I think they're connected. But how do we think about this? And here's, think about this further. What would it mean for somebody to label someone attractive or beautiful of the same sex? Is that wrong? Is there a problem with that? Should women breastfeed in public? This is a big question. Should women breastfeed in church? I have a video to go along with this. Just wait. This is a spoken word piece by a woman from the UK who wrote this about, I think it was about 6 months after she had a baby, and her experience in terms of breastfeeding in public. And so I want you to listen. The video is about three minutes long of her talking about this experience through the spoken word format. So just listen to this, and as you do, reflect on, you know, what does it say about the fallenness of human beings and the societies in which we live.
I thought it was okay. I could understand the reasons. They said there might be a man or a nervous child seeing this small piece of flesh that they weren't quite expecting. So I whispered and tiptoed with nervous discretion. But after 6 months of her life sat sitting on lids, sipping on milk, nostrils sniffing on piss, trying not to bang her head on toilet roll dispensers, I wonder whether these public loo feeds offend her. Because I'm getting tired of discretion and being polite. As my baby's first sips are drowned drenched in shite, I spent the first feeding months of her beautiful life feeling nervous and awkward and wanting everything right. Surrounded by family till I stepped out the house, it took me 8 weeks to get the confidence to go into town. Now the comments around me cut like a knife as I rush into toilet cubicles feeling nothing like nice. Because I'm giving her milk that's not in a bottle. Wishing the cocaine generation white powder would topple. I see pyramid sales pictures across our green globe and female breasts banned. Unless they're out just for show. And the more I go out, the more I can't stand it. I walk into town, feel I'm surrounded by bandits. Because in this country of billboards, covered in tits. And family newsagent magazines full of it. W.H. Smith top shelves out for men, why don't you complain about them then? In this country of billboards, covered in tits. And family newsagent magazines full of it. W.H. Smith top shelves out for men, I'm getting embarrassed in case a small flash of flesh might offend. And I'm not trying to parade it. I don't want to make a show, but when I'm told I'd be better just staying at home, and when another friend gets up, and I'm sure the milkmakers love all this fuss, all the cussing and worry and looks of disgust as another mother turns from nipples to powder, ashamed or embarrassed by the comments around her, and as I hold her head up and pull my Kylie across, and she sips on that liquor made by everyone's God, I think for God's sake Jesus drank it. So did Siddhartha, Muhammad, and Moses, and both of their fathers, Ganesh, and Shiva, and Brigid, and Buddha, and I'm sure they weren't doing it, sniffing on piss, as their mother sat embarrassed on cold toilet lids, in a country of billboards covered in tits, in a country of low-cut tops, cleavage, and skin, in a country of cloth bags and recycling bins, and as I desperately try to take all of this in, I hold her head up. I can't get my head round. The anger towards us and not to the sound of lorries offloading formula milk into countries where water runs dripping in filth. In towns where breasts are oases of life, now dried up in two-for-one offers, enticed by labels and logos and gold standard rights, claiming breast milk is healthier, powdered and white, packaged and branded and sold at a price so that nothing is free in this money-fueled life, which is fine. if you need it, or prefer to use bottles, where water is clean and bacteria boiled. But in towns where they drown in pollution and sewage, bottled kids die, and they know that they do it. In towns where pennies are savoured like sweets, we're now paying for one thing that's always been free. In towns empty of hospital beds, babies die, diarrhea fueled, the breast milk would end, so no more will I sit on these cold toilet lids, no matter how embarrassed I feel as she sips. Because in this country of billboards covered in tits, I think we should try to get used to this.
So I think an interesting perspective, especially, right, this goes back to what we talked about in terms of culture really does produce how we think about sexuality. And that when we look at an example like breastfeeding, here's something that I think clearly this is part of how God made us. But I think what's fascinating about this is that we're in this area, we're so guided by this interpretation of suspicion, but yet we're okay, as she points out, with using sex essentially as a marketing tool to sell. But as soon as it's, you know, something that's free, something that's natural, then we have a problem with it. And so I think that's a really interesting question. I think that kind of gets at how do we do this? How would you, as she points out, I think, do this in a way that's prudent? But also, how do men and women alike maybe need to rethink their expectations about something like this? Maybe a question you haven't considered before. When is sex within marriage wrong? Or is it, right? This is usually, if you have a rules-based view, it's, you know, outside of sex it's bad, or outside of marriage it's bad, inside of marriage it's always good, right? There couldn't be any kind of... So this is interesting. That's just the link to the video there. So here's what I want you to do. Take just maybe 4 or 5 minutes and talk with, you know, 2 or 3 people around you. What question do you gravitate toward, and how would you start to answer that question? All right, so take 4 or 5 minutes, and we'll come back, and we'll see what you have to say to the broader group. Go. All right, we've had just enough time to get started in this. I'm sure in intense discussions, but I'm interested to hear from a few of your groups. What question did you gravitate toward, and what were some of the thoughts that you had on this as a group? Who wants to go first? Yeah.
We talked about the modesty one.
Okay.
And we talked about how, like, usually when people talk about modesty, they talk about only women being modest. Like, modesty is a term that doesn't really apply to men.
Okay.
Very much.
Okay.
And, like, that could be because, like, men are more visual and women are more mental. But then, like, maybe modesty to men is in the way they talk to a woman.
Okay.
Like, they could be modest by the way they talk, not necessarily with the way they dress. So that was just something.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you think, so would you say, is it fair to say in general, okay, yes, men are more visual than women, but can we tend to sometimes maybe stereotype that too much?
Yeah.
Right? Is that part of the, I sometimes wonder about that as well. Did other people discuss this particular question and have some thoughts? Okay, a lot of people went to this one. Yeah.
We did, and there were a couple raised. One was like this idea that, so a one-piece bathing suit, this in terms of women, is considered modest, but if a woman were to walk around in a t-shirt and her underwear, that's not modest, even though it covers the same amount.
Okay.
And so what changes?
Yeah.
From when you're on the beach, suddenly it's okay.
Yeah.
And then when you're not.
Yeah. And so that's, I mean, part, again, I think part of what that does is it says that in some sense, the broader culture kind of defines what, you know, what counts as modesty, right? We do have these rules that, okay, in this time and place, this is okay, and this, it's not. And so that we have to, in some sense, be aware that our standards, even our standards for modesty, are going to be produced by or in the context of the culture in which we live. And so it does get it gets tricky then to say exactly how do we draw those boundaries and how do we understand that. Other groups that touched on this?
I mean, just similar to like the culture thing, how like cultural standards for modesty have changed, you know, drastically, even over the last 100 years, and how, you know, before wrists, ankles, and knees, like that was, if a woman showed those things, then she was not dressing modestly, and men were, like, lusting after knees because that was their context for lust, and the rest was going after the imagination. So yeah. Really, it doesn't. I think a lot of times men are prone to lust after whatever the cultural standard for modesty is. We see the norm and then we take the next step to whatever the norm is and we go further.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And it is helpful to remember there are cultures around the world where both men and women go around largely undressed. Mm-hmm. And that seems to not cause, right? And that's where I mean, even our notions of what produces lust are culturally produced, I think in that sense. Other groups, what question did you discuss a bit? Yeah, Nick.
We did the Should Male Pastors Call Wife Smoking Hot? And we kind of went with two different sections. We did, it depends where he's saying it. Like, if his wife's getting ready to go out and he goes, man, you look smoking hot, not a problem. If he's using it on the pulpit as like an analogy or something, I don't really find that inappropriate. But if he's with a group of friends or something and he's like, oh yeah, it's so hot, and the way he says it too. But then we also put the emphasis on pastor. Like if it's just Joe Schmo from your work or from church that works at Steelcase, and he says, oh, my wife's smoking hot, you wouldn't think anything about it. But it's because we hold them up to a different standard, and they're still human. They still, I mean, they probably have kids. So probably seen her naked. It's not like they're like this saintly person that's never done anything. So he's gonna have feelings for her. So I think that him saying, yeah, I find her super attractive is not a bad thing.
Okay. Yeah.
We also talked about if the wife feels uncomfortable, like with the pastor in front of the congregation calling her smoking hot, then of course it's wrong because the wife is feeling uncomfortable for it. If she feels totally fine with that, I'm not going to say it's 100% right, but it's more right than if she were to feel really uncomfortable with him saying that.
Yeah. So there are these kind of contextual considerations that we have to take in, where it's said, how it's said. Would it change it depending on the age? Like, what if it was a 20-something or a 40-something or a 60-something?
As it gets older, it's more humorous.
And if you do want to, if you just Google something like, because this was like a huge internet kerfuffle for like 3 days. a couple of years ago, well, maybe it was a little bit longer than that, where you have people voicing very strong opinions on this. Online, so it's just interesting to read some of the pros and cons that came out of some of that larger discussion. All right, maybe one or two more groups. Anybody else want to chime in? Yeah.
We talked about the labeling someone attractive or beautiful and whether it's right or wrong in and of itself. And I don't think even in calling a person of the same gender attractive or beautiful, it's okay. Depending on where your head and your heart is at in saying those words. If you're talking to a friend and I say, oh my gosh, you look so beautiful today, it's a compliment. But if you're coming at it from a perspective of objectifying the person rather than acknowledging beauty within how the person is made, it's a difference of your intentions with those words rather than the words themselves.
Yeah. I think that's good. I think that's helpful. As you think even about gender expectations, are there different standards for men and women in terms of labeling someone of the same sex attractive or beautiful? Right. Why is that?
Because women need more affirmation from each other.
Okay. Is that true? Or is it, or will men just not, say how much affirmation they would actually like to have from other men? Everyone, yeah. All men look at each other now and say, dude, you're looking, no, I don't like it. Yeah. Who wants to go first?
We talked about that one, and mine was similar to what Rebecca said, but it was, I think that it's totally okay to say it, because that doesn't say anything about it being a sexual desire. And so it's like, it literally just says, is it okay to say someone's beautiful? And I totally think it is, because I think that it even says right in the Bible, like, God made us all beautiful, so why not appreciate that and, like say that to each other? And I also think that it's okay to say it, like Lee and I were talking about how we've seen a video about this, and, like, it was a girl saying it about a girl, like, saying, like, I can totally appreciate when somebody has a good body. Not saying that I'm sexually attracted to them, but, like, she has a flat stomach, she has good legs. Like, it's okay to, like, see that and appreciate that and notice that, but I don't think it's okay to, like, sexually want that. And that also goes for a guy, too. Like, if I went up and said to a guy, like, oh, you look really nice today, that's not me saying I want to have sex with them, but it's saying, like, you look good and I'm appreciating that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So it just totally depends on the context of the whole situation.
Okay, yeah, good.
This is taking a whole different kind of look at it, but on saying this about or to the same sex, I think this might be more for girls, but if you're saying this and you are saying that they're looking beautiful today, kind of thinking less of yourself, maybe thinking, like, they look way more beautiful than I look right now. I think that's a problem. Mm. And that's something that I think a ton of girls struggle with, and maybe guys do. I don't know. I'm not a guy, so I wouldn't know. But I think that if you are looking at them in that way and comparing yourself on a very deep level, I think that in that case, it could be wrong.
Okay. Yeah, so there does tend to be that that kind of comparison that we do sometimes when we think about this. I mean, I wonder how that even is connected to this. You know, if the pastor says this about his wife, even say from the pulpit, what does that make other women in the church think? I don't know, but there could be a tendency toward comparison.
We talked about how even, like, the difference between attractive and beautiful.
Okay.
It's different because attractive is usually just the outside appearance. But you can say beautiful, like someone has a beautiful heart or a beautiful mind or something. So just even the word that it uses is different.
Okay. So we tend to think, so are we saying that the word beautiful is usually used in a more holistic sense?
Yeah.
Whereas attractive, we usually think about it purely in terms of physicality?
I mean, it depends on the person, but
okay. Yeah.
Someone's attractive, I'm looking to the outside.
Yeah. I think that's probably right in terms of how most people would use that. Yeah.
And I think beautiful too would be more appropriate, because attractive has kind of the implication that I am attracted to you.
Okay.
Saying you look attractive is, like,
yeah.
There's a little bit of that implication, maybe. I mean, obviously not necessarily, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
But beautiful doesn't have any of those implications.
Okay. Yeah, so that's interesting, because you would think, I mean, in some sense, when you say something's beautiful, you say that there is, in my mind, that's almost more powerful. You're saying, like, you are the kind of person who should be attractive, not just, of course, physically, but attractive as a person. And here's what I think is interesting about this question, and we'll probably come back to this, is this is, I think, a key conversation, especially as we think about interacting with gay Christians, especially, to say, is there anything that we can say yes to about your experience? And this is an issue where theologians and philosophers do have some points of difference, but to say, is it wrong for somebody to say, you know, I'm, in my judgment, you are a beautiful person. Even you are the kind of person, maybe I'm not attracted to you, but you are an attractive person, someone who should attract others because of who you are. And so this is where sometimes I think in our discussion around same-sex relationships, there is a danger of reducing that to a kind of purely physical thing, and maybe not thinking through deeply enough this, I think, more basic question, what does it mean for somebody to do this or not to do this? And maybe even from, you know, the male experience, maybe this is why, because at least I think in our culture, my experience as a man, it is much more unacceptable for a man, right? That's a more feminine thing to do, to start to comment on other guys' appearance. Right? That's really, heterosexual men regulate that pretty well. Right? You don't do that or say that, or else you, and maybe some things are changing. Maybe this is my, now that I think about it, maybe this is what's weird to me, is that as a man, nobody really ever comments on my experience until I grew a beard over Christmas break. And now I think that's weird that people are like commenting on my physical appearance, just because that's not really, I don't know, that hasn't been much of part of my experience.
An upgrade.
It's
I said it because it's upgrade. I'm just telling you.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That's right. I'll make that a poll on Sakai. Should I keep the beard?
I think the spice of life too. I mean, you can't have one thing too long.
Yeah.
Just switch it up. It's always nice.
Keep it interesting. That's right. Good. All right. So I want to move on, but I think these are exactly the kind of practical questions that we have to have some kind of deeper undergirding for if we're going to think through these things in some detail. And so today we want to talk about desire and put this in the context then of thinking about the virtue of chastity and the vice of lust, and approach it through the lens of virtue ethics as a way to help us process this. So when we think about desire, what I would argue is that we are, as human beings, created by the Trinitarian God, this communion of persons, that we are wired for love, that we are wired for desire. Now, I think this is beyond just sexual desire, but it includes sexual desire. Okay, so we desire acceptance, right? We desire relationships of all kinds. Right, that we are wired for community in this way, but that includes who we are as male and female, who we are as sexual beings. Now, here's what I really like about Augustine, and I like most things about Augustine. I don't like, actually, a fair portion of what he says about sex, because I think he gets some of this wrong because of his own experience. But what I love about Augustine is his way of understanding who we are, that there is a kind of proper order to our love. That we can think about this, and you could visualize this a couple ways. You could make kind of a list here where we're called to love God and love neighbor, obviously the twofold love that Scripture talks about, but we're also called to love everything in creation. In other words, that we recognize that everything we have is a gift from God. And so because it's a gift from God, it's to be loved, or it's to be used in a proper way. And so when we talk about using something properly, we mean, you know, using it or loving it in a way that fits with the kind of thing that it is. Okay, that it, or another way to say this, it corresponds to the nature of the thing. So if I'm talking about my pets, I'm called to love my pets as animals, creatures created by God, but I'm not called to exalt my pets to the level of my human neighbors. Right? I should love my neighbors more than I love my pets, which maybe I need to make this and put this theological rationale out on my front lawn for the neighbors who, some of whom don't feel the need to pick up the dog droppings, and then my children are playing in the snow, and it's not good. So far, nothing bad this year. But we need to recognize. Yeah, and then all the snow melts, and then you realize how evil your neighbors truly are. Like, that's several months of sin.
If you say that everything is a gift from God, and you see, money is a gift from God, but let's say we have used that gift and buy a pet. We should have used that money for something else. Now we have something that's a result. Oh, I said there might not be a gift from God because we use it unwisely. So how do we view, how does that work out?
Yeah, but if I understand your example, I mean, I would say the thing isn't bad, but the pet's not bad. The money's not bad.
No, but we used it.
But you have, but you've misused it. And so this, I mean, I think this jumps then to his understanding of sin. So we're going to say, I think, understanding creation, God says, it is very good. Everything that God has made is good. There's nothing wrong with the matter that is. But everything that is, as something that's good, can be misused. Okay? This is kind of a, this is sin 101. Yeah,
it is the pet God's gift. I guess that was the point I wanted to make.
Well, it is. I mean, it's very, so I'm using that term more in the sense that this is, this pet has life because God has given it life. And to recognize, you know, that there's no, we don't deserve pets or animals or something like that. All that is, its existence is sheer grace. God holds all these things in existence. And so in that sense, we're not owed anything, but all of these things are gifts that we are called to be thankful for. And the way that we are thankful for them is that we use them properly in a way that fits with that. Now, you know, this is where, you know, when you think about the example of, you know, somebody uses their money to buy a pet, I would say there's nothing inherently wrong with that. If you, you know, if you're down to your last $20 and instead of buying food for your kids, you buy a pet, right? Now, but again, what's the, and then your kids eat the pet because they're so hungry. So when you think about this, you know, what sin is not the pet, it's not your kids, it's not the money, it's not even you as a human being. The sin is that distortion of your love that has caused you to, for whatever reason, make a wrong choice. You've therefore distorted something that's good. In that sense, sin is always a parasite on God's good creation. And I think this is really important to get, especially when it comes to thinking about sexuality and bodies in sin. That that to understand who we are, male and female, and understanding human sexuality, we say at the root here, there is goodness. And so when we think about the many distortions of this, we need to be very clear that they are wrong precisely because they are distortions. And not because sex or bodies are just bad in and of themselves. So even if you were to, you know, take the example of something like pornography, what's wrong with pornography is not naked bodies. Naked bodies in the right context, used in the right way, are fully good. What is evil is the intent. The intent to use another person, not as a person, but as simply as an object. And so this is, I think this is fundamental to understanding theologically desire and even to pastorally trying to work with people, all of us, who struggle in some way, shape, or form with inordinate sexual desire. That you know, we live in a distorted world. We are distorted people. And so we need to be attentive to that. But this is where some people, I think, rightly criticize some Christians for just trying to repress sexuality per se. And just say, well, this thing has been affected by sin, so the best thing to do is just to ignore it or to repress it or to act like it's not there. And that's actually not helpful in the long run, right? That if we're told, I think especially in terms of Christian marriages, if we're told, like, sex is bad, it's horrible and dirty, that's why you save it for a person that you love. Right? How is that? Right? It's so bad. And so sometimes, I mean, I think that's why some Christian marriages can struggle, because if we're shaped and formed by a logic that just says it's something totally to be avoided, something completely sinful, that's a problem. Now, of course, that's completely the opposite, I think, from the broader culture, where it's kind of anything goes. And it's very much not seen in this way. So when we think about desire and what this means, I think it's helpful to actually understand a little bit about what philosophers mean when they talk about virtue ethics. That virtues actually, and this approach to ethics goes back to the philosopher Aristotle. And when I say the philosopher, that's actually what he was called for much of history. So you know you're pretty impressive when people just say the philosopher, and that's kind of your title. But this goes all the way back to Aristotle. And when we think about different theories of ethics, I know that this gets kind of heady in terms of philosophy, but virtue ethics asks the question, what sort of person should I become? And so in that sense, it's focused very much on personal character. Whereas we might say that other forms of ethics, law-based ethics is what I'm calling it here, a fancier philosophical term is deontological ethics. Law-based ethics focuses very much on rules. What are the rules and what rules should I keep? These are two different approaches. Now, virtue ethics, of course, would say, yes, there are rules that you should keep. But the point of this is not just to identify those rules and just keep them to kind of jump through hoops, but to realize it's actually trying to shape you to become a certain sort of person. Right, so you can even think about this. Let me apply this to education and pedagogy for a minute. Maybe you think about this in your experience as students, maybe not. Some students are very law-based ethics. What hoops do I need to jump through in the syllabus to pass this class or to get the grade that I want? Whereas, this is where professors approach the course, I think, from a more virtue ethics perspective. What kind of person, what kind of student am I trying to shape and form? Yes, you have to do the assignments, but the assignments are meant to help you think a certain way, to process things a certain way, to grow as a person, not just to jump through hoops. Now, I realize to survive in education, sometimes there's just hoop jumping. Okay, so I'm not here. I did not come into this classroom to condemn this classroom. Wait, I shouldn't keep it. Because this classroom was already condemned. I came to argue that. But this is helpful, I think, especially when we think about human sexuality. And so Caroline Simon, this is again from her book, Bringing Sex into Focus. You know, she helps us, I think, with this graph, where you see at the top this distinction between virtues and at the bottom, vices. To be a virtuous person means that you habitually act well and you enjoy acting well. Okay, so it's not just that you're doing the right thing, but you're doing the right thing and you're thinking, you know, this is actually fulfilling. This is pleasing. This is enjoyable. Continence is when you're struggling, right? Maybe you don't fully enjoy it, but you're successfully struggling to act well on the whole. Incontinence is when you are unsuccessfully struggling to act well. And maybe, you know, this is one of the weird things about language, is that if you go to like Walgreens, what they mean, right there, you will find an incontinence section. It's basically adult diapers. And so it's interesting how language shifts, right? But they're, I don't know, think of unsuccessfully struggling to act well, right? That's incontinence. Vice is habitually acting badly, and again, notice, enjoying it. And so there's this distinction, and I think, you know, if we're honest, most of the Christian life is kind of incontinence and continence. But there is this aim of habitually acting well and enjoying it. And here, when I think about virtues, I think about one analogy that comes to mind is that of exercise. I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of exercising. It's not a lot of fun, which is partly why I play basketball if I want to get exercise, because basketball is fun. Because then you can beat somebody and get some exercise out of it as a side. So anyway, so maybe exercise is going well, vices maybe are increasing. So I'm not sure how that works. But it's one of those things where, you know, when you just start exercising, it's difficult, and you certainly don't want to do it, and you don't enjoy it. But the more you do it, the more, and I'm not sure actually the chemical explanation, there are chemical explanations, you know, for runner's high and other things like that, but the more that you do it, not only is it something you do because you know you should do it, but you actually begin to enjoy exercising. And then you're one of those annoying people posting things on social media about how, anyway, like, here we are, we're exercising. Here's me with my Doritos on my couch. that kind of thing. So this is helpful then. And when we plug in chastity and lust, this is how she defines chastity. An integrated sexuality resulting in inner unity between bodily and spiritual being, as well as respect for others' sexual integrity. And so I think what's interesting about this is, you know, a couple places she talks about integrity, that there's a sense of body-soul unity, right? That there is, in some sense, this kind of peace that the mind, the will, the heart knows what's right, and the body follows that. And so you have this sense of personal integrity in terms of your own wholeness, but there's also this respect for others' sexual integrity. So go back last class period, we talked about some of these ways that you disrespect somebody else's sexual integrity by reducing them to a mere body. And so chastity involves this kind of sense of self-understanding and self-control and a respect for who others are. And so think about, again in the reading, when they talk about this interpretation of suspicion, a chaste person has the ability, when they perceive other, when they look at other people, they've cultivated the ability to first and foremost see another person and not just a body. And so I would say that, you know, when Jesus says, you know, if your eye offends it, you pluck it out, I think there is some sense of hyperbole going on there. But I think part of the point is you have to cultivate a completely new way of seeing. And so what really needs to change is not just what people wear around you. What needs to change is your own perception, your own heart, that what you see is always first and foremost a person. Sexual continence is successfully struggling to act chastely. Sexual incontinence is unsuccessfully struggling to act chastely. And lustfulness, she defines as sexual disintegration. I think that's, again, interesting kind of play on words there. Sexual disintegration, resulting in habitual enjoyment of treating others as collections of sexual body parts. I mean, that way of phrasing it, it's almost gruesome because it almost sounds like, which I think there is, there's a kind of dismemberment that happens in lust. That you pull body parts maybe away from the whole, and that you pull the body away from the soul. And so I think there's, rightly, this is perceived as being kind of a brutal thing that we would do to others. One other definition of chastity, this is from John Grabowski, a dynamic principle enabling one to use one's sexual powers intelligently in the pursuit of human flourishing and happiness. A couple of things that I find helpful here is to remind ourselves that when you talk about sexual powers, I think he's thinking here holistically about who we are as male and female. And so regardless of whether you're sexually active in terms of engaging in intercourse with others, you are still a sexual being, right? Male and female. And so that's when he uses that phrase, sexual powers, then he's just talking about what it means for you to be a male or female in this kind of holistic sense. Use one's sexual powers intelligently. This is crucial, I think, that we use our intellect, we use our reason to have some understanding of who we are as human beings, and that we then act in accordance with that. And the last thing here, human flourishing and happiness, when we talk about virtues, another way to translate virtues could be excellencies, which is, again, kind of an obscure word to use, but these are things that make us excellent or fulfilled human beings. And so in some sense, when somebody asks, well, why should I be virtuous? The ultimate answer is because you're a human, because that's the kind of thing you are. To be a well-functioning, flourishing human means that you exhibit these virtues. And those who exhibit the vices, that there's something broken in their ability to be a flourishing, well-functioning, good human being. And that's important, I think, to get that if you are a virtuous person, good things will come from that, but you don't try to become a virtuous person just for those things that come from that. That just having those virtues, right, I know this sounds kind of like goody two-shoes, right? Like being a good person, having these virtues is its own reward in the long run. And we'll see how this flips and goes the other way when we talk about lust. It is important to distinguish chastity from celibacy. A lot of times these get confused in popular discussions. Celibacy means that you are not engaging in intercourse. That's different from this virtue of chastity. And so when we think about this virtue of chastity, so this is where sometimes I hear people talk about, you know, single Christians should exhibit chastity, and I think what they mean is they should exhibit, well, they should, but they should exhibit celibacy, I think is what they're trying to say. All Christians should be striving for chastity, whether you're single, you're married, you're widowed, you know, whatever your station in life. This may look different for people in these different circumstances in terms of how this unfolds in terms of their life practices, but everyone should be seeking this virtue. And so this is where, when we think about chastity and lust, this goes back to the question I asked earlier on, is it possible, or when is it wrong within marriage to have sex? Lust doesn't just stop when you become married. Right? And again, distinguish proper sexual desire from lust. Those are different. Lust wants to use somebody else as an object. It is completely possible for married spouses to improperly lust after one another. Right? This is why I think in our popular culture, even in Christian culture, lust just means sexual desire to a lot of people. It's not. It's improper sexual desire, treating somebody else as an object. And so even married couples need to strive for chastity. Especially married couples need to strive for chastity toward each other. Because it is very easy to begin seeing your spouse as something just to be used or to be taken for granted, or even to manipulate. And all of those are ways of violating, I think, the marriage covenant. The Catholic Catechism says a few different things about chastity, all of which I think are helpful. Chastity is an apprenticeship in self-mastery. And this, I think, is an interesting phrase. It's training in freedom. Training in freedom. Again, that when we think about becoming virtuous, the point is not that we're restricted by all of these laws that kind of slowly hedge us in, but rather this is a training to use your freedom to love others well. Use your freedom to love others well, as opposed to, you know, typically we think of freedom being free from anybody telling me what to do. And this is saying, no, because of the kind of thing that you are, because of human nature, you are certainly called to utilize your free choice, but you are not free to invent good and evil. And so if you really want to be free, true freedom means that you learn to choose what is good. And again, this is a very countercultural notion of what freedom is about. It also points out that this is a long and exacting work. It is difficult. It is a struggle. And so there's not a naivete here about, like, you know, this is really easy. You know, you get baptized or you accept Jesus into your heart. Voila. Right. If people are honest, I think, you know, Augustine in his own life talks about how he prayed, you know, Lord, give me chastity, but not yet. Make me continent, but not yet. That there's almost a sense of, I know this is something I should have, but I am still struggling deeply with this. And it points out there are more intense periods in life. They highlight especially adolescence. This is difficult. And I think this is where, again, we need to be honest, even about understanding the nature of the human bodies and understanding the nature of, you know, especially those of you maybe working right now with youth, what happens is people go through puberty and the human body just gets flooded with hormones. That's not an excuse for sin, but you recognize that there are people are at different places in life. You know, that if you're working with youth in that way, it may not be quite the same issue if you're working with, you know, senior citizens in your church. Although maybe this is pretty interesting. I've talked to a few different people actually in social work who've had some experience in nursing homes, and that can be crazy. No joke. I know everyone's like, but that you know, that can be crazy as well. And so it's important to acknowledge this and be clear that not everybody's at the same place. And I think this is important as well so that we don't come across with an attitude simply of judgment or condemnation. Maybe I'm in a less intense period than the person I'm engaged with. And so I want to be understanding about where people are at. It also points out there are laws of growth. I think, again, this goes along with this idea that it's a process and that the goal here is to be making, continuing to move forward, take steps at a time, that there is growth that happens through this, and that, part of the way that we grow is through different means that God has given to us. We grow through prayer. We grow through reading scripture. We grow, I think, especially as we engage in Christian community. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I think when we talk about combating lust, one of the things that we need probably more than anything is a community that we can actually confess to. I wouldn't assume that would be your whole church, but I would assume that you would be connected with certain individuals in your life who you can actually say, here are my real struggles. Because he says, part of the reason that we don't grow is because we don't actually confess. Because when we confess to others, they know where we're at. I can experience both a sense of disappointment, recognizing that I've fallen short, but also a sense of God's grace, and I have people to hold me accountable. He says, a lot of times when we confess to God, I think we're actually, our prayers are kind of bouncing off the ceiling. Because we're not really confessing to God. Because we're like Augustine. Lord, sorry for this. Sorry, not sorry. Was Augustine the original? Sorry, not sorry. I gotta ponder this. But when I talk to another person, it makes it much more real. And so what we need, I think, to combat lust is not simply a good internet filter or something like that, but it's a community of friends. That's most important. They also point out, and I think this is interesting, that the work of chastity, to become a more chaste person, is a cultural effort. In other words, that what you do personally has a broader effect on the culture around you. And this is part of what I like about virtue ethics, is that as you develop as a person, as you become a sort of person, that's not just limited to this one area or to your personal life, but this affects the people around you and it affects the culture around you. And so I think, this is part of what the video at the beginning pointed out. We live in a culture that is oriented by lust. That's how our culture works. That's how our culture operates. But as you become a more chaste person, that has a broader cultural effect as well. And they point out finally then that this is ultimately rooted in God's grace, that it's the work of the Spirit who empowers us to do this. But this doesn't, of course, mean we just sit back and say, well, I'm just waiting for the Spirit to make this all better. That the Spirit enlivens us so that we can walk the path that we should and cooperate in this way. So let me stop there for a minute before we turn our attention from chastity to lust. Questions or comments? All right. Everybody's like, let's talk about lust. Okay, so lust, again, here's where I think we need to emphasize that this is a character flaw. This is a vice. This is not just an action. And so one of the things, again, that I appreciate about virtue ethics is it says, as we are faced with choices, right, each and every day we do make these choices to go one way or another, and these choices start to become habits. And that these habits eventually shape our character, and this character becomes, in some sense, our destiny. That this is who we are. That we shape ourselves in a certain way every day. And every decision that you make is either going to make you a more chaste person or a more lustful person. And what happens, especially, if we think about, okay, so we'll put chastity up here, going the right way, going upward. When we think about what this looks like in terms of our habits, every choice that I make that further ingrains a habit sets me up for the next choice. So if I make a decision, I'm faced with a chance either to grow in chastity or in lust. And if I choose lust, the next choice that I'm faced with, I'm not approaching this from a kind of even playing field. It becomes harder and harder
right? The further I go down this road, I am more and more making myself into a certain kind of person. So that in one sense, I'm free. Nobody's making me do this, but I have fashioned my nature. I have fashioned myself in such a way that really I don't have choice. This is what Paul talks about when he says we're slaves to sin. Nobody's making you do this, but you have made yourself a slave in this way. You know, and this is, you know, important theological questions like, you know, could Gollum have done anything else than what he did? Well, in one sense, I mean, I think, you know, Tolkien recognizes, no, this is the kind of person he is. He has made himself. You know, again, when you talk about character, you know what somebody's going to do, don't you, when you know somebody's character? You know if they're faced with this, this is what's going to happen, right? This is why, you know, my experience, there are some people you just don't have conversations with about certain things. You know how they'll respond. That's their character. You know, they're, if somebody can't take criticism, why have a conversation? That's the kind of person you are. You know what they will do. It is important, I think, to see that Aquinas and others argue that lust usually begins as a sin of weakness, not malice. And I think this is interesting. So when we talk about malice, you're talking about somebody who is kind of intentionally seeking out sin. And so to talk about it this way, I think, is interesting, because it recognizes, I think it goes back to this fact, that we are oriented by love, we're oriented by desire, we're seeking, we're looking for fulfillment, connection, relationship, and that often what you have is people seeking something good, but seeking it in the wrong way. Okay, and that's a part of dealing with, I think, sexual sin should recognize that a lot of people who struggle with this don't do so necessarily out of a desire to really sin. But there are a lot of people who struggle with this, see it as a weakness. I think it's interesting to look at how Jesus oftentimes responds to people who are labeled sexual sinners. Most of whom are women, by the way. Somehow the men are never in these stories, even though you have to be involved somewhere. And so it's interesting there to see the way that he, in particular, shows compassion to those who are struggling, as opposed to first and foremost speaking a word of condemnation. And I think this is interesting, even as we look at our broader culture that is in many ways so sex-saturated, so lust-saturated, we would still say, more than anything, maybe what this shows is there is still this deep longing, this desire for connection, desire for relationship that has gone completely awry, run completely amok. But still be able to see and say, what is it still there that shows something about this human longing and this desire? Rebecca Konendike DeYoung, in her book Glittering Vices, she has a whole chapter on lust, which I would highly recommend. Her phrase here is that the problem with lust is that it reduces sex to a party for one. And so it is very much antisocial, anti-personal. This is something that it further entraps an individual, in some sense, within their own world. And that the end result, then, for a person who is truly become settled in this vice of lust, the disordered soul is its own punishment. This is Augustine, this is Plato, this is others who would say, look, you might think, man, I've got this figured out, how to, you know, totally take advantage of people and just use them and manipulate them, even when it's joked about, you know, like Joey Tribbiani on Friends, which I went up, I found that article that you mentioned, the 85 sexual partners over the course of the Friends. And it says, you know, if you develop the kind of character that can do this, it's not just dehumanizing to your sexual partners, it's dehumanizing to you. Like, you're further distorting your ability to perceive what really is good and true and beautiful. And you're making it more difficult for you, for your own self, to actually enjoy true human fulfillment and flourishing. And so C.S. Lewis has a lot of good things to, interesting things, I think, to say about lust. In The Great Divorce, he talks about, you know, the fact that we think of lust as very powerful. But he says, you know, when lust has been killed and replaced by true,
pure desire, you realize how weak lust really is. You get the sense of the way that Song of Songs talks about the fact that there's love as strong as death. Like this is, we're talking about something that when purified is incredibly powerful, whereas lust is in fact very weak. In The Four Loves, which we'll read later in the semester, he has this great, I think, very insightful phrase. He says, you know, when we say that there's a man wandering the streets looking for a woman, he says, we're wrong. He doesn't want a woman. He wants an apparatus to fulfill his lust. Right? Because when you talk about a person, that's exactly what he doesn't want. He doesn't want a person. He wants something to be used. And in this personal letter, he talks about masturbation, going back to our discussion from a couple class periods ago. And I think, again, this is insightful, thinking about, again, not to say that lust is just connected only to masturbation, but this is one way, one subset of lust. He says, for me, the real evil of masturbation would be that it takes an appetite which, in lawful use, leads the individual out of himself to complete and correct his own personality in that of another. And finally, in children and even grandchildren, and turns it back. It sends the man back into the prison of himself, there to keep a harem of imaginary brides. And this harem, once admitted, works against his ever getting out and really uniting with a real woman. Right? I think, especially something like this, a lot of articles I've read recently about internet porn on college campuses. That this is just, you know, that what's the phrase? Somebody I read said, you know, most, a lot of college women now think of themselves just as kind of bad porn, like they're not as good as you know, this other thing that the guys enjoy. For the harem is always accessible, always subservient, calls for no sacrifices or adjustments, and can be endowed with erotic and psychological attractions which no woman can rival. He continues, among those shadowy brides, he's always adored, always the perfect lover. No demand is made on his unselfishness, no mortification ever imposed on his vanity. In the end, they become merely the medium through which he increasingly adores himself. After all, almost the main work of life is to come out of ourselves, out of the little dark prison we're all born in. Masturbation is to be avoided, as all things are to be avoided, which retard this process. The danger is that of coming to love the prison. A couple of other poetic reflections, and again, these two different poems, but these are both found in De Young's book, Glitter and Vices. And so I want to read these as well, because I think they point out that, you know, a lot of people, you know, sometimes people might say, well, you know, doesn't lust just acknowledge the reality of who we are as human beings, as sexualized beings, as drawn and driven by these things? But from the Christian perspective, lust denies reality. And that is why it often is I think, so dangerous. And so on page 174, on top of 175, you see this poem by Steve Turner. She no longer brought him pleasure like girls in magazines who throbbed with lust and fantasy and stayed sweet 17. He never heard those beauties moan except when in the sack they knew a woman's place to be undressed and on her back. She no longer brought him pleasure like girls in magazines, so they slept in separate beds and snuggled up with dreams. He no longer brought her pleasure, like men in Mills and Boone, who were powerful yet gentle and impeccably groomed. In gray Mercedes cars they drove, their teeth and eyes were bright, they promised their undying love in pools of candlelight. He no longer brought her pleasure, like men in Mills and Boone, so they slept in separate beds, then moved to single rooms. They no longer found their pleasure in lives where flesh was real, so muddled on or called it quits or chased a better deal. Further down on the same page, there's a poem from Madeline Lingle. And she says it this way, because you're not what I would have you be, I blind myself to who in truth you are. Seeking mirage where desert blooms, I mar your you. Ah, I would like to see past all delusion to reality. Then would I see God's image in your face, his hand in yours, and in your eyes his grace. Because I'm not what I would have me be, I idolize two who are not any place, not you, not me, and so we never touch. Reality would burn. I do not like it much. And yet in you, in me, I find a trace of love which struggles to break through the hidden lovely truth of me, of you. I appreciate these poems because they illustrate I think, very well the fact that, you know, when we talk about the dangers of lust, I realize that as Christian college students, you might think of this primarily as a problem to be confronted before marriage. I remember when I had this years ago, we were on a panel, my wife and I, this was probably 5 years ago. Yeah, so there was a panel of like married people, that was us. A panel of engaged, and that was when Ethan and Dana, Ezekiel, is that? Yeah, Dana, right? They were engaged, and there was one other couple that was dating. And so it was, most of the questions revolved around like, how do you not do it before you're married? I mean, that was kind of the main focus. And so I was like, okay, that's, for us as a married couple, is interesting, but because I recognize, obviously, that's the reality of where a lot of Christian college students are at. So that's fine, that's good, I affirm that. But I think the risk there is that, again, people think you get married, and then this kind of draw, this kind of pull into fantasy, right, to kind of fantasize about, you know, especially when you get married and you realize, oh, I'm married to a person. And if you're a good Calvinist, a sinful person, who is, even if you're not a good Calvinist, they're still sinful. So that's kind of the way it works. And all of a sudden you realize that it is, I think there's a whole different type of temptation or a whole different type of pull. Maybe you wouldn't think about lust in this kind of sexual way, but a kind of just draw towards some kind of ideal that isn't marred by the reality of what we are as created but fallen human beings. And so I think the Christian vision of chastity wants to sort of stand firmly with 2 feet planted in reality and say that our call is to develop this kind of love for others, love for our spouses, that ultimately is going to see to lend toward our flourishing, toward their flourishing, toward the flourishing of children, Lord willing, family, church, and so on. I have a couple other things I want to say here, but I'm going to stop and save those for next time because it's more than we can do in 2 minutes. So we'll stop there for today. There is, again, be sure that you're keeping current with the different reading worksheets. The one for next time is posted on Sakai. I'll see you then.
That's my favorite quote.